Hi, everybody, and welcome to another episode of The Language Worker. Today is super special guest, super special in all sorts of senses. I'm sure many of you are familiar with her. She's a well-known person from a well-known company, and she's somehow part of our lives as language workers, obviously. So thank you so much for being here, Olga. I will not dare to pronounce your name because you will beautifully do it for us.
I'll absolutely do. I absolutely will. So thanks so much for having me. The last name is Berregovaya.
Right.
I don't know what else do you want me to say about myself other than
Okay,
that?
just a little introduction,
Okay.
basically why you are in the language business or in the language world. Now I looked because if I was all mixed up with the schedule, I'm like, oh my God, you're actually usually based in California, but you're not based in California today, right? Is that right, or are you
Yeah,
there?
that's not quite the case, actually. I mean, to add a fun fact, well, I mean, it's absolutely not a fun fact. To add a fact to today's conversation, I am indeed based in California, and last night we had a tsunami warning. So I wasn't quite sure. I just came back from self-evacuating myself and the family. We just came back from hiding inland. So as of today, I'm based in California. It felt safer than being in Mexico. But other than that, I'm usually between California and Mexico.
Okay, because you're right in the south of California, right? In the San Diego
Yeah, right in
area,
the
is that
south,
right?
right on the beach. But again, luckily for us, it was a false alarm,
Oh my
yet
God.
worth the drive. So, but yes, I'm generally between California and Mexico. And maybe saying a
Okay.
couple words of introduction about myself.
Yes,
I've been in
please.
the industry. It's funny, every time I submit my bio for a conference, I have to be honest and add a couple of years to how long I've been in the language industry for. So going on 30 in the language technology industry, being pretty much exclusively in the language technology and natural language processing space. And hopefully, if not evolving with the space, then at the very least, watching the evolution of the space. So started as a lexicographer and parser builder for rule-based machine translation for one very, very famous, if not the only, not one of the few at the time,
Eastern.
rule-based. And then just, come on. Yeah, well, yeah, kind of. But stayed in the language tech industry and like developing more and more, I guess, into or moving more into leadership roles and managing teams of researchers and language engineers. So that's my industry trajectory.
I started as a lexicographer myself. Isn't that funny?
Yay, okay, hello.
Let's say that it wasn't necessarily in the more tech-oriented part, but that's definitely because they were doing the ever first Academy dictionary in Portugal. So that's I got involved in that project. So that was a pretty hands-on thing to do right off college. So.
You know what's funny though? The funny part is all those dictionaries that we built and all those ontologies and all those taxonomies, they come in extremely handy now, right? When you really are looking for how do you augment the new reality with some previous knowledge, right? And that was like, okay, well, I thought those dictionaries and those like all the dependency trees and ontologies and like word nets were the thing of the past until they are not.
Yeah, exactly. I know. I'm in terminology, so I hear you. It's like new words that were old words that people didn't care about so much, terminology, lexicography, lexicology, and all of that. And now they're kind
And
of
hey, now I'm a knowledge
in the
graph,
moment.
right?
Exactly.
And now
Knowledge
just like
graph now.
now I'm a knowledge graph, and LLMs rag into me. So yes.
Exactly. So, because I've never seen you before, I mean, we've never talked before, and I always pretend that I'm in like my private virtual coffee shop, right? So let's go back just a little bit, just a tiny bit, and understand why you actually decided to dive into the language world. Was it your family was already multilingual? You studied languages in college? What happened?
Okay,
Just a little bit.
let's get the family out of the way. All my
Okay.
entire family are physicists and
Okay.
metallurgic chemistry experts. So when it became apparent to the family that they did not raise a physicist in this case, that was like an absolute family disaster. Like, okay, well, okay, we got ourselves a failure. Like this girl is not going to Department of Applied Mathematics and not getting her PhD in physics. But I was always, yes, indeed, I studied, I went to school that was specializing in foreign languages. And then I come from extremely multicultural city, St. Petersburg, Russia. So languages just came in natively because they were right next door, right? So, after that, I studied applied linguistics at the university. So, never been a translator, but literally mostly focused on structured language and mathematical ways of processing language. And then, as time came to like, okay, what am I going to be when I grow up? That's exactly, and I did my master's in the US already. And this is exactly where DoD started putting a lot of money into different DARPA grants for language technology. And it looked like, hey, I can actually see how I can be a part of all those projects, not necessarily DoD projects, but projects that were sponsored by different government entities. And it was like, okay, well, hey, I can do that. I speak a few languages. And that's where the career path started. And again, you probably maybe remember those times and maybe know about those times. That's where language technology became front and center. Right. And
Yes, I've been
then,
around for a while too.
okay. Yeah, but then, right, at some point, suddenly NLP, OCR, grab a piece of paper, OCR it, and translate it instantly into foreign language, or sending workers out into remote areas. And in those remote areas, they still need to be able to have signal. And many workers would be multilingual, communicate with the main office or with their supervisor. Suddenly, there were so many applications. It was the most exciting field to be in. And like, Lord, now it is the most exciting field to be in. So
What else can we do? We just love it.
aren't we lucky? Aren't we lucky? All I can say.
Yeah, we are lucky. So, were you immediately brought into a company, or did you go through a phase of being a researcher, things like that, or your career started and you went immediately to work at a company?
Well, I mean, I did my grad school, so obviously I did some studies there. But when it came when it was out of grad school, I pretty much immediately got immersed. Again, I was lucky to land that parser building and like the whole dictionary and taxonomy building project. So no, that was pretty much baptism by fire. That was pretty much
Wow.
from the get-go. Also raising a child at the time, I didn't have the luxury of just like, let me take a couple of years and see what I want to do. It pretty much was college and then straight to work and then learning on the job. And I remember, apparently just like you remember, sorry, dear translators, that we made you post edit the output of early rule-based systems. Right? That might not, we could have done better
Well, I
than that.
have to say I have been dealing with output since raw output since probably 2007, 2008. So I have seen it in pretty maybe not early because you were right there for you. Maybe this is not early, but for me, now that I look at it, I'm like, wow, this was already a long time ago. And a lot of people were experimenting, and I still do that with clients. So I like looking at whatever output, right? It's not, it's I like looking at it with the eyes of a researcher always, and it's like, oh my God, what is it? Before I have any other thoughts that are more philosophical.
Absolutely. And that was also very interesting. And that's why I think the whole concept of like, hey, we've machine translated something, and now machine translation post-editing surfaces as a concept. I think it was fantastic to see the evolution of the quality of the automated translation output, right? The statistical was a major breakthrough where suddenly the dependency of what you actually put into the system and transfer systems was not there, right? And then we see the evolution to neural machine translation. So it's great to see how much the quality output of not only improves, but also changes. And the nature of errors change. And the nature of what a human in the loop is dealing with changes dramatically based on what the system can actually come up with.
So how have you been living this thing through the line of time, like a big a chronological line if you draw it? How has it been for you as a professional on the job,
Okay.
right? Because of course we have our concepts, our ways of thinking about things, but
Right.
how was it for you in your day-to-day life to actually constantly be dealing with the whatever was coming out in the industry?
Well, being on the first enterprise buyer side and then on the technology supplier side, it was all about practical applicability. So it was really, and that's another area which I'm thrilled to see that the gap between researchers and academia and practitioners, it was huge, and now it's pretty much non-existent, right? The researchers put their research, write their PhD and do their research based on field data that the practitioners out there or technology developers out there bring to them, and vice versa. I see that the I don't know, practitioners, implementers like myself are much closer to following what's happening in research. So for me personally, I think it was very interesting to always measure applicability and impact, right? Because I'm in a place where people pay money for certain things, and you want to make sure that they actually are impactful. So for me, it was great to see how much the field is evolving, the whole field of natural language processing, and see that indeed the customers save more and more time and money. Indeed, the translators are becoming more and more productive. And I already mentioned, like, there was rule-based implementation, and the expectations were very modest. Like, if the translator is 10, 15% more efficient, great, we're happy. And if a certain small portion of content is publishable raw, we're happy. And see that transition from complete human-based translation to content that is just doesn't warrant full human translation is migrating over to the automated translation side. And also watching humans becoming more and more effective and the ability to take products to market much faster. I think for me, it's great to see how much more impactful our work is, and our work as a field and our work as a profession.
Right. So talking about profession, right? How do you analyze a company, right? When you're thinking about moving from one company to the other, since you have this unbelievable overview of everything that's happening, you're placed in very strategic positions, obviously. So how do you actually go about moving jobs? Because you have worked in quite a few companies. What kind of criteria do you have? What kind of goals do you have when you go somewhere? Is it because you want them to give you something, or is it because you want to bring them something and you can see
I
that they
think it's
can?
more, I think, well, I mean, it's always mutual, right? But I think it's more what I would bring to the table. And as I said, I was on the buyer side for what, 7 years? Yes, I was on the supplier side. And then for 7 years, I was on the buyer side. And at some point, I was like, okay, I've already, within the state-of-the-art technology, I have already built everything I could have built. And I'm totally in a place where I can hand it off to the most capable team I was working with. And I was like, okay, enterprise implementations take time. Enterprise implementations at scale take time. And I already mentioned the concept of impact. So the first time I hopped from the buyer side, and everybody's like, okay, what are you doing going to the dark side? I was like, no, because I went to lead a small machine translation company, and I was all about immediate impact. Like, I have an idea, the team has an idea, and we see it in the product and we see it implemented, whatever, 2, 3 weeks later. So I think that was the thrill when I first time changed jobs, really left an enterprise job for the supplier side, was I can move fast and I can see the impact of my work very fast. But then you are at a small company, and at some point you're like, yeah, you know, it's all great, but it'll be interesting to have a backing of a bigger company and see impact on larger scale. And that's when I changed jobs and went to a localized where I happily worked for 11 years, almost 12 years. And that was, again, I ran the R&D department, the language technology department, quality department for some time. And again, it was all about, okay, I bring all the learnings from being deep in technology to how we can implement it across different enterprises. And the beauty of being on the supplier side is you work with so many different domains and so many different content types, right? And like, you go visit a client and the client says like, hey, how about after the meeting, I give you a ride on a tractor. Or you go meet a client, and next thing you know, you walk away with like a discount coupon for a major retailer. So that was that. And the latest move was because Smartling, I've always been super friendly with Smartling as a company, and a fan of a product. And at the time, it was 2.5 years ago, SmartLink started or decided to make a major investment into the machine translation, now to become AI translation practice. And we spoke, and it was like, okay, here is back to immediate impact of my work and an investment and willingness to invest into research and development. So now I'm blessed to have a team of 8 people, and we work very closely with product and engineering. So it is, again, it's all about making things happen,
Yeah.
right?
So was the big explosion, let's call it that, for the larger public in 2022? Were you already working there at SmartLink?
Okay, so if we look back, GPT-2 came out in like 21, right? Probably 21,
Is it
22.
the very end, like November 21, or is it
I think it
already
was very end
something like that,
November of
right? From
21, and I think I mentioned it at a recent conference or somewhere. That was my wow moment. Like GPT-1 was okay, well, let's watch it, like kind of interesting, let's see what they can do. And when we tested GPT-2, I was back at Willow, like, holy Lord, this thing is extremely powerful. And I think that when I moved jobs and when I went to SmartLink, that was exactly when it was already very obvious that generative AI and foundational models are the thing. So I think I moved over to SmartLink exactly when it became the real thing. And I think the major pivotal point was when the models became trainable, right? Because the first two generations of GPTs were not trainable. And when you realize that you can actually adapt it to a domain, an industry, or your customer's tone and voice, this is where things became extremely exciting. And
Yes.
I moved over, and I moved over towards the mid 2022, exactly when equally interesting things started happening and the hype began.
So with all the big things that are around the things that you do, how would you say to someone you find on the street, because we have this problem, people who work in languages, I think, especially in the more technology-oriented part, how do we talk to people? What do you say to people when people ask you what you actually do? Or what SmartLink does and you do in it as a part of it?
Okay, so first things first, what I actually do, I was once talking to a CEO of a major enterprise. It just happened so, like, it was one of those parties where you can bump into anybody under the sun, and I lived in San Francisco for a long time in the Bay Area, so the odds of bumping into a CEO of a major tech company are pretty high there. And I was like, so what do you do, Olga? And I was like, well, I do localization. I was like, do what? I was like, well, you know, like maybe you've noticed that your products actually ship globally, and this is where I come into play. So this is, I mean, the first thing is just, okay, well, if you're a brand, I'll take a brand global. And usually I say, we grab your brand and we take it global end to end, from text-based, from the product to all the collateral to e-learning, legal, and everything in between. So that's how I try to explain it. And now, when I try to explain what SmartLink does, again, it's a global content deliver AI, fully AI powered global content delivery platform. And if I see that my counterpart is like, oh, well, yeah, what? I was like, well, okay. Again, same thing. Imagine a brand. Imagine that the brand needs to be go global super fast. This is where AI and my job come into play. And we have brand and yeah. Or if I speak to a person who's like not from technology world at all, I would probably say that SmartLink is there to bridge the linguistic divide. And we use AI to bridge the linguistic divide, if we go a little bit more philosophical about it.
So when we talked for the first 2 minutes without recording that we talked, you said that you have a little bit more time for research these days. What does that look like in your world since you are, at the edge of everything that's happening? What is research for someone like you?
Okay, there are two things, and I think we at SmartLink have figured out the balance between you stay appraised of state of the art, but at the same time, you don't chase the next shiny object. And I think that's the biggest danger of the modern time and day, because something new and something like that looks exciting pops up every day, right? We wake up in the morning and we wake up to 5 new models and 10 new approaches. And then that one same model is deciding to get compressed or, like, that provides model distillation. And then there are different sizes. So it is essential to be able to always know what's happening in the research world and have that practical mind to know what's relevant, what can wait, and what will never be relevant to your work. So for me, first and foremost, it is, are we doing the best? Are we really driving the best outcomes with the technology that we have at our disposal? Do we have our own strategy around technology? And yeah, and just basically watching what's happening in academia. Now, because of the AI explosion, it is also a fine balance between being in the know and staying sane. Right, because you're dealing
Exactly.
in full on, and I don't know how successful I am at staying sane, by the way. I don't know how I'm doing in that department. But it really is like not being swept away with a tidal wave. So for me, the research is I subscribe to a lot of newsletters. I have, as I said, I have the most amazing team that we run research papers channel. So always looking at what people have posted to that channel at my private time, like say when I'm whatever. On a treadmill, I always make sure that I listen to podcasts. And I also, I'm a big proponent of practice what you preach. So I use AI, I use summarization and extraction tools, just loading a bunch of papers on a certain topic and just run like towards the end of my workday, just run like, okay, so what research papers are top of everybody's mind? Which research papers get most views? And then just run summarization on them because I think it's virtually impossible to be apprised of everything that's getting published. And then obviously you also need to be hands-on, so also reviewing the latest prompts that the team has created and just thinking, okay, do I have any ideas based on what I've researched lately of how to do it differently?
Okay. Sounds fascinating, especially the treadmill part.
Well, okay, that was a bit of
So,
a, I was thinking about the treadmill. Like, I mean, that's a bit of an overstatement. It doesn't happen that often, but it does happen.
I won't judge you, don't worry.
Okay.
So just before we go, because I know you have lots to do, and also there's lots of things happening around you today, so I won't keep you too long. But just before we go, just imagine, I think for you it's almost impossible to imagine that, business owners who have like a substantially big company have not actually decided or made any moves on their AI strategy in terms of our field, right? So what kind of advice would you give them, like in terms of tools, where to start and how to somehow put something into place immediately so that they can start, testing or piloting, seeing what's going on?
So first things first, if AI is not implemented in your global strategy and in your global content strategy, you're definitely behind the curve. So advice one is make sure that AI is a part of your universe. Second advice that I always give is secure, and it's not only because I'm on the supplier side, but it's just common sense. Secure a solid, trusted advisor and a trusted partner that has already been there, done that. And that can actually help you identify the areas where AI would be most applicable to your work. So that's the second one. Secure somebody who's already been there and follow them, whether it's your existing partner or whether you're looking out there. Second, I would go with measured deployment and make sure that you don't go on this wild sheep chase and you don't just go out and just say, like, okay, well, here is the API. It's at my disposal, or the MCP server, right? The next big thing is at my disposal. Let me just plug it in and just say, like, okay, I'm done. It happened. Actually measure what you're doing, establish metrics and KPIs, and make sure that all of your initiatives are working towards those metrics and KPIs. And the next advice would be always measure the ROI. Always measure the ROI and think whether the juice is worth the squeeze. Because it just implementing, even if we talk about Gen AI, just implementing JAI into your Gen AI into your processes, tokens don't come for free. So
Yes,
before
they
you
don't.
force, they just I mean, I think it's a major oversight on the part of the Gen AI providers. I think they should be a little bit more philanthropic than that. No, I'm joking. I mean, they are there to make money, just like all of us. So measure the deployment, measure the ROI. Again, make sure whether it's internal people or whether it's your trusted advisor partner, make sure that your strategy and your technology implementation really get you the best when it comes to your investment. I was working with a client that gave us what, like 3,000 or 4,000 token prompt to deploy in the system, and it delivered fantastic results. But once you start counting the money, it's like, oh, actually, could I have done it with 200 tokens? So it's also just make sure that you're wearing your research and ROI hat. So these are my four pieces of advice.
Wow, that was at least one extra. The usual three. Very good. Well, I hope everything works out for the best with you moving around in the land, right? Because it was a complicated night, evening, and all of that. So I hope everything works out fine for you. Of course, you're safe. You're great. So that's good to know.
And I
And
hope everybody
nothing
else is.
happened in the end. So great. We're talking about the tsunami possibility. And thank you so much for this. And it was great to meet you. And I'm sure we will meet again very soon. So thank you very much for
Lovely.
this
Thank
and
you,
have a
Heather. Thanks
great
so much
day.
for having me.
Bye.